What are the race issues that we all have an opportunity to take a look at? Stay tuned as we find out on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yes. Once again, those are my babies. As always, thanks for getting daddy started today. Mwah. Author and nationwide speaker Bruce Jacob is with us, and I am curious. How can we improve race relations in this country?
Well, good day to you, Frank. It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
We need about, maybe another 200 years before we settle that question, and we have an hour. But let's talk about it, you know, as authentically and as clearly as we can. Mm-hmm. I think the first thing we can do is recognize the depth and breadth of the problem that we've got, and the fact that for 400 some odd years, all of us on this piece of ground that we now call the United States of America have been walking around surrounded by lethal toxins all the time. What a friend of mine calls carrying heavy metals within yourself. Mm-hmm. And when that's the reality and you don't accept it and deal with it and face it, you get even sicker than you would if you face it and try to purge yourself and try to cleanse yourself and lead the kind of life that we'd all like to lead. So I think that's the starting point, is facing it. And there's so much we can talk about. We can talk about how all of this is boiling up literally through this election, mm-hmm. and the ugliness and the nastiness and the drama of this particular electoral cycle. And we can talk about how all of these things have, as long as we've been alive, affected each of us personally, as they do, and how we move ahead with that. So we can kind of pick a place to start. We can start any particular place. We can start with the election if you want. I mean, to me, that's, I know you start with talking about in the news, and that's certainly in the news. So we can go there if you want, or we can start somewhere else.
Well, one place I want to start, given that we're going to be talking about race, we can go to the heart of what may be, not necessarily though, each of our biases. I'm a black male. Nancy, you are?
A black female.
Jeff, you are?
I'll let you know later.
Perfect response. The mystery unfolds, ladies and gentlemen.
You'll keep us in suspense, right?
I'm a white male.
And Bruce, you are?
I am a black male. I'm an African-American male.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Relationships is really what we focus on here on the show. And everything that you said thus far can be applied to relationships. When you said having the honest, very honest conversations, that those can be rare in some relationships also. So many of the things that we're going to touch on, there's some natural carryover. And so I want my wonderful co-host, Nancy, to think about that. Jeff, you, and Bruce. Let there be a relationship conversation in everything that we're going to talk about also. So can we all do that? Can we,
sure.
Can we consider that?
You mean in the context of what's happening politically or in any way?
As we talk about race.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
I think that's absolutely right, Frank, because race is in and of itself a relationship.
Absolutely.
By definition.
Absolutely.
It is a definition of yourself in relation to other people. And much of that in the United States, in our legacy of what we call race, is artificial. It's a relationship built on untruths and imbalances of power. And so, yeah, dealing with it as a relationship is the only way to get through this humanly, I think.
What are some of the lofty abstractions or policy arguments that you want listeners and just a greater audience to avoid kind of lingering on?
Well, you know, the convenient ones that we linger on are, number one, that this is the greatest country on earth, and we are a democracy, and we are the envy of the world. Much of that has
Bruce,
truth to it.
We're going to walk out of this show friends. This is, I'm amazed. Like, you are the first person I have ever, maybe not ever, but you are one of the very few people I have heard actually question or you know, push back on the statement that is thrown around so much. This is such a great country. I mean, and I wonder, is that just promotional material? And does everybody in every country think that? And you know, you touch on the democracy thing also. That's just as rich to talk about. But please, you know, finish. Jeff, you got something there?
I have two things. There was a show on HBO called Newsroom. Mm-hmm. If you've never seen it, go on YouTube and watch the first scene of the first episode. Mm. I think it ran for 3 seasons.
Okay.
It's brilliant.
New, old, 5 years, 20 years?
3 years ago.
Okay.
No, 4 years ago, because it lasted 3 seasons. Jeff Daniels is the star. Mm-hmm. And it deals with, he's a journalist. He's Tom Brokaw. Mm-hmm. But he's a journalist. And he's at a lecture, and someone asks, why is America the best country in the world? And for the next 5 minutes, you will be riveted with your mouth open. It's brilliant. It's really brilliant, regardless of how you feel or have perceived our country. The only thing I was going to ask as you asked Bruce that question is, Bruce, how old are you?
I'm 61.
Perfect.
You are, Jeff?
I'm in my 50s.
I'm 44. And Nancy is 53,
50-ish,
I think,
yeah.
52, something like that.
And the reason I'm asking, Bruce, is was the motivation for you studying this and becoming an author on the subject personal?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Second, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yes, I started writing these race books. There have been two of them so far. And I have to add that it's not the only thing I do as a writer. Mm-hmm. I'm a poet, I'm a musician, I do other things creatively with myself, and it all kind of mixes together. But I started writing these race books precisely because I was raised in a family that taught me to be myself all the time. And when I ran up against a world that refused regularly to do that, I started looking for a way to get past that and to push through that without kind of devolving into bitterness and unproductive rage. So I started writing these books as a kind of antidote to myself for this sense that, you know, you're shouting in a room and everybody sees your lips moving, but nobody hears what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And that's why these books and my approach to it is as basic and kitchen tabled as it is. It's like a combination of sociological philosophy and history and Dear Abby, because it's that basic. So yes, is the short answer to your question.
Well, no doubt it's a necessary story and subject to share. The original question on age was, maybe it should have been geography. Did you grow up in a quote-unquote black neighborhood? Were you homogenized? Did you experience busing? Were any of these things, the social issues that led you to want to explore the topic?
All of them were. I spent the first 8 years of my life in a mostly black but mixed neighborhood in Rochester, New York, mm-hmm. Which was a strictly segregated city at that point in the early 1960s. When I was 8 years old and we moved to an all-white neighborhood against a petition against my family moving in, which is another story,
wow.
I learned that year that I was black. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew what color my skin was. I knew that I was a black person walking around.
But you learned what it meant to be.
I learned what it meant mm-hmm. when I was 8 years old. And from that time forward, I have been, like, working in various ways, sometimes productively, sometimes not, to integrate and push who I am into the fabric of a society that often doesn't want to hear it, doesn't want to see it, doesn't want to know it. So all of those things informed me. My mother was part of a voter registration drive. She was part of a push for racial progress. And she and my dad were part of a generation of Black Americans. This is not a unique story. It's a common story, as you know, whose only ambition really was to be Ward and June Cleaver. Mm-hmm. That's all they wanted, was to be the Leave It to Beaver family. Mm-hmm. And when the society would not let them, that politically radicalized them. And I came out of that whole experience. So, yeah, that's all part of why I'm here talking to you. Absolutely.
Welcome to Frank Relationships, a show for you, my brethren, who, like me, are too young to be considered old and too old to be considered young. It's also for those of you who love and support us. We're here to provide weekly wisdom, conversation, and the information that'll help you create a loving and flexible parental and partnerial. Is that?
Here we go.
Partorial?
Yeah. Here we go.
It is now.
Create loving and flexible parents and partners. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. If you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please follow us, and if via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get the show each week. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please give us a favorable iTunes rating, and please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We're always looking for new social media friends, so please help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. Greetings to my super-duper co-host, Nancy Goldring.
Greetings, Frank.
The consummate generalist.
Indeed.
Yes, yes. Today's guest is an author and nationwide speaker, and he tells it like it is. In his latest book and his speaking engagements, he stands up for the values of social justice and for rehumanizing the ways in which we advance what we believe. With his dynamic presence, his plain-spoken clarity on difficult issues, and his empathy with audiences, he's able to encourage people of goodwill to challenge all forms of bigotry and to work for the kinds of social and economic fairness that benefits us all. So, if you, like me, want to know this, I have a problem even saying this. What the $250,000 sale of the gun that killed Trayvon Martin is telling us.
Yes.
And what he wants Black and white Americans to know. Then stay tuned as your Frank Relationship team talks with the author of Race Manners for the 21st Century, Mr. Bruce Jacobs. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Before we get too deep in today's subject matter, we're going to check in and see what's in the news. Bruce, please don't be bashful. We want you to weigh in. Okay, first up, Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. Does anybody care?
Oh, the divorce?
Yes, yeah. I'm gonna first say, I don't know what's going on. I'm the first, like I said on last week's show, okay, when we talked about Nate Parker, mm-hmm, we don't know.
Right.
And with anybody's marriage but mine, I don't know. So let that be my preface. Now, you know, the floor is open. Anybody want to jump in, give their 2 cents?
Jeff is looking
I wish I had time to care.
Yeah, Jeff's looking like, I don't care. Nancy, you care?
I'll get back to you about that after I go fishing.
Yeah.
Hey, how about there's some good-looking folks. They've got a lot of money, mm-hmm, and they've got a Black kid.
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
Yeah. I think, do they have just one?
I don't know. Honestly.
Here we go, Lord.
They make some good movies. I like Ocean's 12. I mean, you know. But you know what? People do some people's lives revolve around Entertainment Tonight and Us Magazine and the blogs. And it, again, God bless them. I wish I had the time
to care.
to care.
Well, I have to say, though, guys, I did attend my I was, my sister got married this past weekend. Mm-hmm. And I heard something in the ceremony that I just don't ever remember hearing before.
All right, let her rip.
And so as part of the minister pronouncing them man and wife, and, you know, they say what God has joined together, no man put asunder, right? Mm-hmm. Well, somewhere in that process, he also charged the audience, those assembled, gathered here today, so to speak, he charged us with supporting their union and doing what we could as a community to support them being and staying together in holy matrimony. Hmm. And I was just like, I never heard that before. Now, I'm not telling you they don't say it every time. Mm-hmm. I just never heard it before.
Are you trying to tell me that the preacher or the pastor or whoever married you when you got married,
he might have said it. Wait a minute.
Obviously, nobody was listening.
Well, I got news for you, though. Now, here's what's really deep about what you're saying. My ex-husband was at the wedding. Okay? My ex-husband was at the wedding. Now, you have to understand something. My ex-husband and I would have been married 29 years a month ago that weekend, right? Mm-hmm. So September 20th of this year, we would have been married for 29 years. So there are several people at this wedding that are saying, oh, are you guys getting back together? So, when you talk about a community standing for your union, there are people who are still standing for our union, mm-hmm. even though we have been divorced for, say, 25 years.
Mm. Okay.
So
I have a issue with that. I mean, actually, I don't have so much an issue with the assertion, you know, help these people stay in matrimonial bliss, you know, that sort of thing. I don't have so much an issue with that as it is what that may look like. Like, that could look like so many different things to so many different people.
I don't think that people mean that in a way that's unhealthy for the couple. I heard that, like, two people making that quality of commitment to one another uplifts the community. And so it's in the best interest of the community to support these people in honoring who they say they want to be for one another.
But how does that community do that? Oh, so do you?
It's
do
the
you...
same as what you said earlier. It looks differently for different communities and different marriages. I suspect it at the very on the ground, it looks like, don't try to interfere in their relationship, meaning don't try to get with the man and don't try to get with the woman. You know they're married to each other. I think at the very minimum, it's help them to honor their marriage. You know, don't go over to Anna Mae's house in your stockings. You know what I mean? I don't know. I'm just saying.
Even
Bruce,
with that. Okay.
But are you there? Can you help me with him?
I'm here. I'm not sure I can help, but I'm listening raptly to all of this because number one, I mean, yes, you know, bless Angelina and Brad.
Yeah.
You know, they are two good people from all that I gather.
Right.
In a really, really difficult place.
Yeah.
And I wish them, you know, I wish them a way through it that's as healthy and loving as it can be in
right.
that situation.
I agree.
And as a child of divorce who watched my parents' marriage not so much explode all at once as sort of dramatically dissolve over a period of years and years and years, and who still carries that pain and the kind of fear and caution with me relationally as a result. I can feel that. And part of what I hear you saying, it sounds like, Nancy, maybe not, maybe I'm just projecting this, maybe this is me, but part of what I feel here is a want, a desire to honor a certain amount of kind of, it takes a village, like shared communal relational love, in which a lot of our romantic relationships, a lot of that's missing now as a context for relationships between loving partners, say.
Yes.
And I think part of what, not just, not messing around and doing stuff tangibly to weaken the marriage, you know, by flirting or by, like, funny business.
Mm-hmm.
But by having a kind of village-like intimacy, a kind of, you know, people talk wistfully about back in the old days when everybody knew everybody and
right.
kids could run out and play and not work. And, you know, that's trite, but it's also, there's truth to it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe part of what he was talking about was wanting a kind of loving setting in which a loving partnership can flourish in a society where we're bowling alone. You got your little cardboard house, and you come and you go, and you might not even know the names of the people two doors down. And that's not good for us.
Right.
So, I don't know. But that's one thing that I heard.
My take on it is I truly believe to support you and your relationship or marriage, my way of supporting you in your relationship or marriage is to believe that you know, the two of you know what's best for you. And there's, I don't.
So you mean to stay out of it?
I stay out of it. I'm staying out of that. If you ask me something, I am going to do all I can to give you my 2 cents that I believe will support your union, not your bias or question or issue or would not make you feel good. And that might be, that might very well be, I'm not touching that.
Okay,
you know, love you, love your partner. That's
okay.
The, you know, do your best to support and love your partner and work through whatever it is for as long as you can work through it. Be loving and accepting. That, you know, that might very well be my advice. And that's about it.
Okay. Oh. One word.
Yeah.
Okay. Kind of
like
fair.
As much as possible, mind your business, because I've got my own issues and I'm trying to work through my stuff. And, you know, I'm learning me just like you're learning you. And for me to jump in as though I know what's good for you is not good for me. Okay. All right. Bruce, on to the good stuff. What divides blacks and whites in this country?
Well, to start with, the fact that a certain group of folks who ended up here were brought here in chains, captured by force, made into slaves to build the basis for an industrial economy from which they would disproportionately not benefit, and defined as quote-unquote black versus the kind of racial or, if you like, superficial physiological skin-based background, there's a phrase for you,
mm-hmm.
of the folks who were of the conquering and colonizing groups being defined as white for purposes of expediency. This is a way to explain, well, you know, how can you treat other human beings this way? Well, that's easy. They're not human beings. So we can treat them any way we want.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're making money and we need to do this. So that's the basic starting point, I think, of the difference of where our experiences diverge. But that goes all the way up to the present day,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, the statistics show the differences between things outcomes that are likelier for me, say, as a black male, than outcomes that are likely for a person who would be called a white male. If you look economically, if you look physiologically, if you look emotionally, if you look at how we deal and how the police deal with us and what we're likely to encounter from strangers on the street and in public places, you know, all of these things are chasms, they're divides. And how we deal with them defines how well or not well we get along. And so far, we've managed to survive and lurch along, but just kind of barely.
Mm-hmm. And how would you ask, as a black male, how would you ask a white male to look at that same scenario?
Well, you know, I would... And this loops back around to one of the things that we kind of started at the very beginning of when we were talking about having this conversation, mm-hmm. which is the whole Trump phenomenon and what's going on with why a man with as obscene a history and as blatantly not just morally challenged but legally challenged and ethically challenged all along the line set of characteristics is even in the running for the presidency of the United States, and half of the voting electorate, more or less, is still willing to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that my message and what I've been saying for years and years and years to white audiences and to white people individually when I have the opportunity is that you're being played. There's a thing called white privilege, and there's a history by which you've been taught that certain things are due you as a person who's defined as white. And when those things are withheld or withdrawn, you feel denied something that you're entitled, even if it's subconscious. And secondly, you lose the ability to understand who your true enemies are. I go to Montana. I've been to Montana a bunch of times. It's a beautiful state. I fish there. I have friends there. And I talk there. And I give talks there. And I interact with folks. I go to Montana. And the short version is a white guy stands up and recites a litany of complaints as to why he resents and blames people of color and welfare queens in Chicago for the things that are going wrong in his life. Mm-hmm. And his litany is exactly the same litany, I mean exactly, as what I hear from a black woman in Harlem on 125th Street in a bookstore who stands up and recites the same list of problems that are catastrophically problematic in her life that are all caused, in her words, by, quote, the white man.
Mm-hmm.
And what I say to both of them is, you know, there's a black woman in Harlem who I want you to talk to. And there's a white guy in Bozeman, Montana, who I want you to talk to. Because when you get beneath it, what's really beneath the Trump phenomenon, I think, is that white folks who are suffering, relatively uneducated white folks, who are suffering in a global economy where wealth has shifted dramatically to the top and left them behind, with all their expectations of what is due them, need some place to go with that rage and that energy. And if mainstream politics won't give them a kind of populism that says, yeah, you're right, it's busted, it's broken, it's rigged, we got to fix it, then a racist and misogynist demagogue will come along and give it to them. And that's what we're looking at right now, I think.
That's a mouthful. Okay, so Trump, I mean, that's really who you just captured. What do you think, sum up Trump, is he a character? Is he doing what he thinks a certain population would want to hear? Does he believe what he says? What are your thoughts?
You know, Frank, those are really great questions. And I have no idea. It's like, you know, it's almost like asking about, like, you know, what are Brad and Angelina going to do? Because And I have a better idea, actually, of who they might be and what they do than I have about Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I have no idea who that man is or what he wants or what makes him tick. And I'm not sure that he does either. And I really don't care very much, to tell you the truth. He's a really, really dysfunctional guy.
How do you define dysfunction?
I define dysfunction as not being in touch with what you really want and how to engage other people in a healthy way to get what you want.
I don't
know
if
he's... That's why I define it as dysfunctional.
I don't...
I see Trump as... There's a really interesting essay by David Brooks, who to me is a very, very smart, thoughtful conservative, who wrote an essay, I think it was in the New York Times, not too long ago, about Donald Trump's loneliness and about how profoundly sad it is to see a guy with billions of dollars, not as many billions as he claims, but a lot of money, raging around through his life with nobody in his inner circle with whom he can really be intimate enough to trust. He's got to give orders to everybody, and at the end of the day, he trusts nobody, and nobody trusts him. And when he loses the election, as it looks like he will, in David Brooks's world, in David Brooks's words, Donald Trump's entire team will just go home. And he'll be sitting in his private plane and in his sumptuous penthouse alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, he can always make another reality TV show.
And I think that's part of the plan. I think in some ways this is a commercial for the next enterprise, which is the Trump Network, a kind of fascistic reality TV series that takes what he's stirred up with this electorate and tries to make money off of it. I think that's probably where he's going. But to answer your question, I don't know that he knows who he is, except that he's ceaselessly hungry for attention and for power. We know that. And he'll do just about anything and say just about anything to get that. And in a way, as a poet, I can kind of relate to him in that way because I really do think he has a gift. He has a sort of almost sorcerer's gift for being in front of an audience and closing his eyes and feeling what they want and feeling what the id is, right, in Freudian terms, in that room. What's the animal in that room? And then opening his mouth and roaring and groaning and kind of gurgling, you know, like making the sound of that animal, conjuring that animal for the crowd's desire. I think Trump does that, and he's good at it. And the problem is that he's a liar, a racist, a misogynist, and a fascist. He's a wrong poet to be capturing and hypnotizing a crowd. But in the absence of the right kind of poets taking out that message with empathy to folks who need to hear it, Trump is what we get for that segment of the electorate that has lost so much of its dignity and needs it back.
And with an interest in providing some balance, what do you say about Hillary?
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton was never my first choice ever. I think Hillary Clinton is a respectable and I think well-meaning mainstream corporate-backed candidate in a corporate-based electoral system through which money is the basis for access to electoral power. And she is using that pulpit, that traditional, you know, 20th century, 21st century basis for power, which is out of a tradition of every other corporate politician who's come before her. There's no difference. It's not as if she's created this all of a sudden. And she's using this to do the most good that she knows how to do within the confines of the power structure that she's working within. So is Barack Obama. Absolutely, I think. And I don't think there's any question, to me anyway, that with the choice put before us, Hillary Clinton is the must-choose for anyone who wants any kind of sane way forward. Absolutely. There's no question. But I think Hillary Clinton, like Barack Obama, actually, and I've written about this a lot over the years because I think it's true, is I don't know her personally, but I think She's a good person who essentially means well, who is trapped within a system that created her own basis for power. And she kind of doesn't have any place to go that's not based on that system of kind of corporate-based privileged and what mainstream politics, as we take it for granted, will allow. Bernie Sanders was willing to push beyond that and to do it fervently with some of the kind of firepower that Trump carries as a progressive and as an honest progressive. But I think Bernie's message was too far beyond what the corporate monarchy, and I think that's what we're talking about, will allow. It was not allowable. Hillary Clinton's level of a sort of mediated social progressivism is allowable within certain limits.
She's the devil.
And everybody knows that Donald Trump is going to blow up the machinery. So he's kind of a no-go. But the problem is he's tapped into real progressive rage. And that's the irony here, I think, is that what's being called a conservative, and it is, a conservative fascistic kind of powerhouse in Trump's appeal is really largely based, I think, in progressive desires for more economic fairness and justice among suffering white people. But racism and misogyny and other kinds of manipulative, wicked wielding of power are used as sort of ways to like tilt the energy in another direction by Trump and by others. That's the irony, I mean.
Well, you know what, Bruce? I'm listening to you, and as I hear you saying essentially that Hillary is the devil we know, and we're not exactly sure what we're gonna get from Trump, and yet I reflect back on the conversation we had on Friday, and I think you used a perfect metaphor when you called him the lance that pierced the boil on the race conversation, and essentially that he is saying what other people have been thinking, or how they've been feeling for centuries. He's put it out there for, it's like he's just put it out there like, okay, I'm going to say it. And the only reason I can say it is because the rest of you have been thinking it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And that's part of the irony, is that you know, such a raging liar would functionally turn out to be such a wickedly effective vessel for truth, right? A certain basic truth, which is basically, you know, working and non-working white Americans looking up and saying, hey, wait a minute. You promised me a bunch of stuff when you brought those black folks over and put them to work in the fields and didn't put me to work in the fields. And now the longer it goes, the less I got and the more somebody else has got. What up? Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump's answer to that is, well, what up is these other people have to be put back down. When in truth, you know, like you're saying, I think, both the black woman in Harlem and the white guy in Montana need to look at the tiny, tiny, tiny group of men, mostly white, who are making the decisions that are screwing up both of their lives. And that's the underlying truth, which Trump's message, despite its wickedly racist and misogynist tilt, is tapping into. Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful podcast. You know, I'm gonna go back and look up that HBO series because it sounds powerful, and it reminds me of something that's on right now that's actually true. It's a podcast that's created by WNYC and The Nation, and it's on right now. Maybe 3 or 4 episodes of it. It's been running for a little while. A friend just told me about it a few days ago. It is called The United States of Anxiety. And okay. It is a podcast that talks to, really, really talks to white folks, not just white folks, but one of its main lines of inquiry is what white folks who are suffering in parts of the country that are heavily pro-Trump really have to say. I mean, really have to say. Not what Trump has to say that appeals to them, but what they have to say is powerful. And it gets to kind of where the passion behind this Trump thing comes from. Because a lot of Trump voters, you know, what I'm hearing is, I don't so much like the guy. It's not much. It's not that I have to like the guy or that I have any respect for him or that I don't think he's a pig. It's that, you know, he's saying stuff nobody else will say, and somebody's got to do something.
So I'm going to piggyback. I want to piggyback a little bit on Nancy's question. So what do you say to an angry white male and his wife and children that have the experience and the perspective of, and you've already touched on this a little bit, of, look, we brought these animals here to work for us. We established this country. We slaughtered the Native Americans because we had to. We needed to take their stuff. We needed to take their land. We took their land. We annihilated them. That's what we needed to do. Good for us. And we put these animals to work to make this society what it is today. It's ours. We won. This is how we made it. What do you say to individuals that have that perspective and want all associations related to the animals that I'm speaking of, the Native Americans, other nationalities or other races, want them basically silenced? Like, you all, get out of my face. Get out of my face. Yeah, right. We killed you once. Yeah, right. We killed you as much as we need to. We've done everything we needed to do. We'll do it again if we have to.
We are doing it with mass incarceration.
Sure. What do you say?
Well, to be honest with you, Frank, not much. I mean, one of my rules about this whole kind of racial conversation thing that we're talking about is, and because you need ground rules for stuff like this. And one of my ground rules is that I engage, number one, where there is what I would call goodwill, which I would define as basically the intent to not do harm, right? An intent, regardless of ignorance and, you know, perhaps misinformation, that is not based in the desire to harm others. And that's basically the pool. And it's a big pool of Americans, I think, who are within that conversation.
But now, even the people...
Let me
cut you off right there. Even the people I just characterized don't mean harm. They mean money. They mean industry. They mean they're out for land. They're not out they were not out to simply annihilate the Native Americans for the sake of that. And they weren't out to enslave Africans for the sake of enslaving Africans. They had a purpose for doing so that was self-serving. So, I kind of disagree with you there.
Right. Well, what I'd say, Frank, is that when you embrace those causes as necessary causes, you are embracing harm. You are consciously embracing it. Now, you might not be willing to acknowledge that it's harmful to embrace those things, that it's harmful to move forward, you know, as a conqueror and to continue that legacy as a conqueror and to think that that's necessary and good. But it is, in fact, harmful. And I'm willing to say that, and I'm willing to act on it. I don't think that that is where most of the Trump electorate is. And I don't think that that's where most white Americans are, at least not in my experience. But to answer your question, my answer to somebody who's coming from that place, and there are people, there are definitely, you know, a significant chunk of Americans who are coming from a place like that. My answer is, well, okay, I get it. You know, that's what you want. I'm on the other side of that battle, and we're going to win. You're not going to like it, but we're going to win. We did it with ending slavery. We did it with women's suffrage.
We did it with the end of legal segregation. We will do it with mass incarceration. It's happening now with gay rights and LGBT rights. And, you know, we will win this battle for a more just society on this bloodied piece of ground. I'm going to fight just as hard as you are for what you want. And I'm going to work just as passionately as you do with the folks on your side of this battle, if that's where you want to line up. I don't want you lined up there. I want you with us. I want us to be pushing together for what's good for all of us. But if you won't do it, I will do it with folks who will. And that's my answer.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we've been talking with the author of Race Manners for the 21st Century. He's Mr. Bruce Jacobs. Bruce, please tell us what you're up to and how our listeners can find you.
Sure. Thanks for asking. Well, I have a couple of books out, the most recent of which is an updated version of a book, as you said, that's called Race Manners for the 21st Century, M-A-N-N-E-R-S, for the 21st Century. It's on Amazon. It's around. You can find it. You can also go to my blog, which is Alias Bruce, A-L-I-A-S-B-U-R-C-E, aliasbruce.typepad.com. And you can see more of my stuff there, including a piece I just put up. I think I mentioned it to you, Nancy, about Trump and exactly what we've been talking about right now, what's going on with that.
Okay,
that'll give you my blog site, Alias Bruce, will give you links to other stuff that's going on with me, including talks and interviews and other people doing things that that I want to share.
Along today's journey, we've discussed Donald Trump, the United States of Anxiety. That's a podcast to check out, and the angry white male. We often talk about the angry black male, but there's the angry white male too. Thank you to my co-host, Nancy. Thanks to Jeff Newman, my engineer, and thank you to my guest, Bruce Jacobs. You've been great.
It's a pleasure. I appreciate it.
I hope you've had as much fun as I've had hanging out with today's ensemble. As always, it's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that'll help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr. That's M-R Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening via Blog Talk Radio, make sure you like us there, and if via iTunes, make sure you subscribe so that you can receive each week's show. This is Frank Love.